everybody, and welcome back for another episode with your internet historians. I'm Nicole.
I'm Lisa.
And I'm Alec.
How y'all doing today?
Why do I feel like it's been like super stressful lately?
Dude, yeah. I feel like I have so much to do with so little time, but then on my days when I'm home, I feel like I'm not doing anything at the same time. I'm like, wait, what? Like,
because you're like exhausted.
Then I don't know how this, well, it's because I have been closing a lot lately. So I go in at one. And before that, I feel like I don't really have time for much. Cause like, you know, I wake up around maybe like around 8 or 9 and it's like, I got to eat my breakfast, you know? And then I got, I try and do a little bit of cleaning.
I always hated working at the end of the day. Like when I used to work at the pizza place, like my shift would be at like 5, like dinner time. And I'm like, what the heck am I going to do with my day? Like, I can't get involved with anything. Cause then I have to go to work. It's the worst. Yeah,
totally. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I feel like I've been, I don't know. I just feel like every single day I'm like, I want to work out. I want to do this. I want to do that. I want to clean. I want to whatever. And it's, I never have time for it. And it's just annoying. How do I make more time in the day?
I know, that's me all the time. But, and then I feel like on my days off, I'm like, okay, fine. If I don't have time to do this today, I'll do this on my day off. And then my day off comes and I'm just like super tired. And I just want to sit around and catch up on my TV shows. And
I was going to say, I'm like, we need one day off. Cause even after this, I told Chase, I was like, okay, after I'm done recording, we are cause we have a, like this downstairs closet that I swear just, we just throw stuff in constantly. Even some of the cupboards in our kitchen, like, cause we have storage space, but we don't really like use it for anything. So we just throw things in like cupboards in the kitchen and whatnot. And so I was like, after I'm done recording, we are going to clean that shit out. Cause I want to throw a bunch of it away. And at first he was like, no, but he was joking. He was like, no, we're not going to. And I'm like, yes, we are. Cause I am tired of looking at it. I hate looking at just junk.
I know, me too. But I do the same thing. I end up, I have a junk drawer and then like every month I have to go through it because I keep throwing things in there.
Yeah. I'm like, dude, our closet downstairs is a mess. I'm like, I don't even know what. And we just throw things in there. I'm like, where are we gonna put this? I'm just put it in the closet. It's just jackets and other random crap down there. But yeah, so that's my plan for after this.
I've got to do a bunch of cleaning because we are having a birthday party at our place on Saturday. So
kill all those Black Widows before people come over.
I was gonna say,
dude, I would freak out if I had that many freaking spiders in my house. I freak out for the random one or two that come into our house every now and then.
If they come into the house, I freak out, but outside, I don't freak out unless they start like running. Cause when they run, it's like, oh,
what about the one with the eggs?
That was disgusting. I wanted to throw up.
What do you do with that? Yeah. What do you like?
Yeah. So when I was little, and when I say little, I was like 12. Me and my cousins, we burned an egg and all the little spiders started running out. So I'm like terrified. I know.
I'm flapping our arms like, no.
Hell no.
Yeah. So with the eggs, I kind of, so far that's like not happened. We just like.
But when they get born, don't they just swarm out of the egg and they're just
they get born.
Over your whole house?
Yeah. No, I don't think they like take over the house. I think they go in. I don't know why I think of like Charlotte's Web and they fly. The wind takes
but all those Black Widows.
Yeah. So really what we do is we just like smash it. Like we just take it away and smash it somewhere.
I don't know why I feel bad when you say that. I'm just like, oh, that's so mean. But then
you know, you're just like
disgusting. I know.
I get
all I was gonna say, I have noticed is that a couple of these eggs, like, after if the widow leaves them, they just stay there. Like, I can't imagine how long are eggs supposed to I can't imagine that eggs take that long to, you know, but I've noticed they just like ditch them and they just those are ones are kind of easy, I guess. So ones where
I know we every now and then we'll have like a spider that gets in the house or any type of bug really that gets inside the house, and I'm always trying to tell Chase to kill it, but he's like, no, like, don't kill it. He's like one of those people, and I get so mad when he doesn't kill it and I just kill it myself. But he's like, wow, you really did that? I could have taken it outside. I was like, well, you weren't doing it, so I had to do something about it. So
well, Luis isn't like that. He is more of the type that's like, you need to conquer your fear, and I'm like, shut the fuck up.
Well, Chase isn't afraid of it, he just doesn't want to kill it. Like, he feels bad for them, and like, he's like, oh, that's just a small one. And I'm just like, okay. And I've read something online, because I was like, I forget what, I was looking up something about spiders in the home or whatever. And they were just saying that, like, if you find one, it's usually like not trying to be out in the open. It's like also lost. So it like wants to like go back to wherever it's from too.
It's also lost.
Basically, just like leave it alone. Yeah, like leave it alone. It like doesn't want to be there out for you to see it anyway. So, but it's just like it lost its way or something. And I was like, yeah, fuck that. I'm killing this thing. So I still
you invaded my home. It's like if somebody walked into my home, I wouldn't I guess I would be like, get out.
That is how I
but if they couldn't figure it out,
I wouldn't kill them, but like but I would
kill the burglar.
I wouldn't kill them, but I would be justified if that did happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
exactly.
It would be self-defense at the same time. So
right.
But anyway, we start the episode today?
we're gonna go in a different direction.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so in today's episode, we will be discussing the history behind the movie Temple Grandin. Before enrolling in college, famed animal husbandry expert Temple Grandin visits a cattle ranch owned by her aunt Anne and demonstrates a brilliance for all things mechanical. Once classes begin, the autistic Grandin rises to meet the intellectual challenges, though the social ones are a bit more difficult. Grandin triumphs over her prejudice to become an innovator in the field of animal care and a lifelong advocate for humane slaughtering practices. So what do you guys think of the film?
I thought the beginning was kind of difficult for me to get into, but once I got into it, I started to like it.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the movie. I just felt like it was kind of boring at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, it was good, but it was like, it wasn't like great, you know, like at least to me, it wasn't great. I felt like it was just kind of like, I mean, I was like invested in it the whole time and everything, but I feel like towards the end, I'm like, okay, I'm ready for this movie to like wrap up, you know?
Yeah. There was a point where I had to check where we were in the movie. I was like, yeah. Are we
like, how much time is left on this thing? I do that sometimes too. I'm like,
Yeah, I liked it, but yeah, I agree. It kind of did have some pacing issues. Like some spots were a lot more interesting than others, and but overall, it's pretty interesting. I mean,
yeah, I'm saying it was a good movie, but I mean, like, I think other aspects obviously were good about it, but it was just, I don't know, the story that's like about someone, but it's very like much like a biographical film. Like I feel like those are kind of more, if they're telling the story of someone's life, they do lean kind of to the more boring side, at least for me, maybe. I don't know. I mean, that's all what we do here, right? We just watch.
I was gonna say that's all we watch, though.
But I mean, like, some of them are way more entertaining than this. This was like very much just like, okay, this happens and this happens. Then I don't know. But I mean, overall, it was what you said, like educational for sure. Like, I learned something from this movie that I didn't think I was gonna learn. I didn't even know about this movie until we put it on the list. So,
same.
Yeah.
Never heard of her.
I saw it when it came out.
Yeah,
did you see it? And then I'm like, it's an HBO, right? Yeah, it's an HBO movie. On HBO. Yeah, but yeah, last time I can't remember if we finished recording after that, but yeah, I saw it when it came out, and it was a pretty big deal when it came out. I mean, and then I looked it up because I remember a lot of people talking about it, and it won quite a few Emmys, like Claire Danes. Did. But people really liked it.
Let's see, I think I was reading some type of article when I was doing the research on this, where Temple Grandin was saying that she really enjoyed the movie and felt that Claire Danes was like acted exactly like her. She's like, that she did exactly like the things that I would do, or she like sounded exactly like me. So
I don't think she sounds like, I don't know, maybe she did then, but I watched her TED talk. I didn't think she was so.
I was about to ask, did you guys watch her TED talk?
Yeah, I did.
Watched it right after. Because I wanted to hear what she sounded like too.
Yeah, exactly.
I was gonna watch some stuff, but I decided not to.
Her TED talk was pretty good. I mean, it was only like 15 minutes long, I think, so it was pretty short, but it was, yeah,
she made it seem very accurate.
Yeah, she seemed like she had no problem with anything. I mean, it sounded like they kind of worked relatively closely with her. I mean, she said that all of the illustrations and drawings and stuff used in the movie were her actual drawings.
Yeah.
So she seemed like she was really excited about it. Mm-hmm. So.
And she said that when they would flash the pictures, it was like how she sees it. So I thought that was cool because how do you show that?
Okay, let's talk about Temple for reals now, guys.
Good old Temple. Okay, so I'll start. All right, good old Temple. Temple Grandin, she came from a wealthy family. Her first name is actually Mary, but one of the family's employees, I mean, they write that and I'm like, do they mean like their maid or something? So I don't know. It's just my assumption. Yeah, I know. But one of the family's employees' name is Mary as well. So to avoid confusion, they called her Temple, which is her middle name. So Temple's mom, Anna Eustacia, which I think in the movie, they just called her Eustacia. It's like, I guess everyone just goes by their middle names. So Eustacia, in the movie, they mentioned she mentions how she was a Harvard graduate. And that's true. She did graduate from Harvard with an English degree. Temple's father was a real estate agent and heir to the largest corporate wheat farm business in America at the time. So that's why they got money. Money. So I read a little bit about it. It was like really interesting. It was like, I couldn't even wrap my head around it. It was something how like whoever, the great grandfather worked at a bank and the bank went bankrupt, and to pay them, they gave him land. I don't know. I think it was something like that. So Temple has two younger sisters and a younger brother. And I think one of the younger sisters is dyslexic. So Temple's diagnosis. So that was kind of confusing to me because it's like there's two different reports of saying she wasn't diagnosed autistic until she was an adult, but also she was diagnosed autistic at two. And I think it just
at two, that's early.
Yeah. I think the difference is that like autistic then just meant brain damage. So like, I think just the definition of it is different. So yeah, at two, basically they said she had brain damage and yeah, the doctors did recommend that she be institutionalized, but her mother refused to do that. And her father wanted her to be institutionalized because he just thought, you know, doctor's orders, it's kind of, it's like, I understand because at the time they didn't know, right, what is the best way to treat this. And I guess obviously if a doctor's saying one thing, you think, oh yeah, like the doctor's right. Right. But the mom was like, no, I don't want to be away from my daughter. And that's why she decided to keep Temple. And she went to like other specialists to see if there's any alternatives to institutionalization. Eustacia hired a speech therapist to help with Temple because she did say like she did have trouble speaking as a part of her autism. I forgot like how she described it, but she said in her TED talk how she just had had a hard time learning to speak, but with a speech therapist she was able to learn how to speak. Eustacia also hired a nanny to play educational games with Temple, and the schools that Temple went to also created a better environment to help with her sensitivities and needs. So Temple considers herself very fortunate to have had supportive mentors from elementary school and onward. She does say that middle school and high school were the most unpleasant times in her life, though. And this is more so because of the kids taunting her. They, you know, called her, I think it's record player. I didn't write it down, but it's because she like would sometimes repeat things, like how we saw in the movie. She would say something like over and over and over again. And they also mentioned in the movie how she was expelled because she threw a book at somebody, which is true. So after she was expelled, they sent her to a private boarding school, and that's where she met William Carlock, the science teacher, and he became her mentor. So he helped her significantly towards building up her self-confidence. And yes, in the TED talk as well, like, even though she says that about him, there's also the fact that she talked about him over and over again, and you could tell she continues to admire him and really points to him as somebody who helped guide her through some times and helped her realize how she can navigate her life better. So something that he did was refocused some of her obsessions. And she also says that as like kind of a way to help guide other autistic kids. So when we talk about like the squeeze box, so in the movie, she like made it when she went to college, but in real life, she actually made it when she was still at the private school or private boarding school. And then she wanted to bring it to college, but they weren't allowing it. And so Mr. Carlock suggested that, you know, she could do a scientific experiment with it. And so then that way it kind of shifted her focus, because instead of being so focused on this fact that she can't have it and getting upset over it, now it's like, I'll do an experiment. And then her focus shifted. And we saw it again towards the end of the movie when she got really upset when her dip design was taken apart by the ranch handlers, and that made her really upset. And she went over to his place and he said, hey, let's talk about slaughterhouses, you know, and she shifted her focus from that design to like redesigning a slaughterhouse. So just helping with that, because she says, you know, in her experience, sometimes she would be like really focused on something, and when he helped her like kind of refocus on something else, it really helped her mind just like explode. Sorry. I just like didn't know what's like the right word. It just kind of like
explode.
Yeah, she was able to do more rather than continue to fixate on one little thing. Mm-hmm. Something else about Mr. Carlock is that because he's such a huge mentor in her life, she feels, and he was a teacher when she was at school, she feels like this is the best way to help other kids. You know, having, I don't want to say the teachers we have now aren't great, but like maybe more support so that the teachers can, you know, help a certain student if they need a little bit more attention. So she talked about, you know, yeah, like she just thinks that like these teachers need to help like navigate that this student needs a special need. How can I help them? You know, if it's help them refocus into this, you know, just thinking of other ways to teaching this kid versus like you have to just kind of assimilate to how everyone else is doing things. Mm. So that was a lot faster than I expected. But yeah, I think that Mr. Carlock was just, yeah, a huge influence. And to this day, mm-hmm. I don't know if it's till this day because the TED Talk was from 2010. So it was like 11 years ago, but I'm sure she still talks about him in a nice manner.
Like legit cried when he died.
It was really sad.
Yes, I was sad because it was kind of like what she was saying. Yeah. He was there 1 second and then he was gone and yeah. They kept showing him in the casket. I was like, oh, he really yeah. believed her, in her.
Yeah, I know. And it's like interesting because not that she doesn't have a reaction to those things, but she's just like, oh, well, that it happens. It's kind of like an inevitable thing. It just happens. People, you know, leave this world. And I don't know. Yeah. Because I don't know, you would think that it would like almost set her off to have something like that happen, but it doesn't. She just views it in a different way than a lot of people do. But what I'll say is I do. Oh, sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, you see in the movie as well, every time she has a hard time, she calls him. She went over mm-hmm. to his house, and you start to like almost worry that if she goes through another hard time and he's yeah. not there, like, is she going to be able to re-navigate her focus?
I'm sorry, he had cancer, right? I can't. Do you say that or what
illness? I didn't say how he died. Oh. I didn't look at the specifics.
Yeah. Oh, sick. I thought I saw something that said he had cancer. Maybe I'm just imagining that in my head.
Well, when someone says sick, you just immediately think it's cancer.
Yeah. Right? I mean, I don't know. But yeah, I do like how her mom kind of was just not really accepting the, like, I don't know, diagnosis or whatever that the doctor's saying. Oh, and how they like, you know, like blamed her and stuff. How she was just like, no, like, yeah, it's not my fault. Yeah. I'm like, yeah. So.
I agree. I like she says that her mom, her, like the resilience of it all, like in just mm-hmm. focusing on trying to help her daughter versus like, yeah, just sending her to an institution. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you don't want to say like the parents who did do that is bad, but it's just that like it actually helped mm-hmm. Temple more than the others. Oh, another thing I wanted to bring up is the aunt, Moira, which her real name is Anne. Well, not Moira's real name, but the aunt's real name is Anne.
Yeah. Not the actress's name.
Yeah, sorry. So
which is Catherine O'Hara. Sorry.
I was actually really surprised because, you know, the aunt seemed to like really want to help Temple, and, you know, she did go over there for a summer, and it was when she was 15. And I was shocked to discover that that's actually Temple's like stepdad's sister. And her mom didn't marry her stepdad until she was like 14. So it's like that aunt, I guess in my mind, I thought that aunt had been in her life since like she was a child. And mm-hmm. so it really like blew my mind that like this aunt just probably knew her barely for a year and was like welcomed to her home and was being so accommodating. So I thought that was really cool.
I just, like you said, like that her mom was very resilient and like not trying to give up and be like, no, like that's not the end of the line for my daughter. And I don't know. Yeah. In the movie, how they were like, oh, you should bring your husband in for me to explain this to you. And she's like, no, I have an education. I graduated college, whatever, blah, blah, blah. She's like, you can talk to me about it. And I'm like, hell yeah.
Yeah.
But I feel like in the movie, I mean, I don't know if she was really like this because I didn't really read too much on it, but I just don't like how in the movie, because I mean, it's not the vibes I got from reading about her, but like how they made her seem very like, not spastic, but like kind of just like overwhelmed by everything all the time that was going on. I mean, I'm sure she was, but I don't know. I just feel like the way they portrayed her in the film made her seem like extra, like, oh, I'm so worried about my whatever. I'm just like, I don't know. To me, it seemed like it was like, at least from what I read, it just seemed more like she was trying everything she could to like help her daughter. And like, I don't know. And this one, it seemed like she was more just like frazzled and I don't know.
Maybe they just maybe did that would. Because it, I think for like a parent trying to help your kid and you don't know how to help your kid, like you're just doing random things, maybe she internalized it so she didn't actually act like that, but they wanted to like make it more dramatic.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. Like you said, because she probably felt that inside, but yeah, in the movie they make it more of an outward thing so people can understand, you know?
Anyways, that's all.
Oh, I didn't have too much either.
That's cool. I like short episodes.
I was going to say, it's going to be a short episode. I mean, it's pretty much it's like how they showed it in the movie, pretty much, which is good. So her work with animals. Okay. So in 1980, Grandin published her first two scientific articles on beef cattle behavior during handling, livestock behavior as related to handling facilities design in the International Journal for the Study of Animal Problems and Observations of Cattle Behavior Applied to the Design of Cattle Handling Facilities in Applied Animal Ethology. I did not realize that there were so many farm journals.
I was going to say, I didn't realize farming or slaughtering or whatever like took all this mental
that it was like such a process that there's so much to it. I mean, which you would hope that there is a lot more to it than it seems. I mean, like, I guess I never really, I mean, I'm not a vegetarian or anything, I eat beef, but it's like I don't ever think about it. I don't want to think about it because it's depressing, but it's just like you hope that the animals are being treated well. And that's like one thing that I did like about this movie. I mean, she really changed the way that animals were treated. And it's just like, it kind of gives you peace of mind. It's like, I said, I'm not like a big proponent of like the beef industry or anything. Like I eat meat, but it's just like, it makes me feel better.
Yeah. Like the whole thing with the spider, like you were talking about earlier, you don't want to know about us killing it.
No, I don't want to know. Just let it outside. She was one of the first scientists to report that animals are sensitive to visual distractions in handling facilities, such as shadows, dangling chains, and other environmental details that most people did not notice. When she was awarded her PhD at the University of Illinois, she studied the effects of environmental enrichment on pigs. The title of her dissertation was Effect of Rearing Environment and Environmental Enrichment on the Behavior of Neural Development in Young Pigs. What a title.
Nice. I know.
Brings Yan.
I'm like, sounds interesting.
Yeah. Grandin expanded her theories in her book, Animals Make Us Human. She has quite a few books. I didn't count how many, but like I was like on her website, like looking at all this stuff that because she's like, she does webinars. She does lots of talks. It's like, she has like a webinar like scheduled like every month. I'm like, dang, I was like kind of interested in watching one.
She doesn't take any breaks. Books, right?
What?
She has children's books, doesn't she?
I think so, yeah. I mean, quite a few of them are on autism and like two parents raising kids with autism and stuff like that, which is pretty cool. In 1993,
I just realized I totally wanted to look up the Jello and yogurt thing, and I
oh, it's true.
Yeah.
She did do that.
Oh, it's true.
Oh, I saw it. It was in one of the things I was reading.
Interesting.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, so she, because you know how I said she was doing a whatever interview about like how she thought Claire Danes did portraying her, and she was just talking about like you said like oh like the photos were ones that she did, and then she's like, and yeah, the yogurt and or pudding and whatever the hell else it was, a Jello. I was like, what was it? And she's like, that was true. I was always eating that stuff or something like that. But I think her palate has changed. Like she does eat other things now.
I thought it was because she had some like IBS or something.
I don't remember her saying that. Yeah, she said that she did say
something about stomach issues. Probably. Or something in the movie.
I don't know. But she just said that she did like eat a lot of Jello pudding and stuff.
Okay. I guess. I just remember thinking like, how are you able to be with like all that cattle and you know, I think I just imagine it taking a lot of energy and all you eat is Jello.
I know. I'm saying like, how do you get all your nutrients? Taking, like
supplements or something, but yeah, I was thinking the same thing. But my mom has a former patient that's like a good friend, and she has a son with Down syndrome, and all he eats is chicken broth and ice cream. That's like all he eats, all he will eat for every meal. But I mean, she obviously makes sure that he like eats vitamins and stuff like that to make sure he's like getting, but it's just like,
yeah, he needs like protein, right?
Yeah. So in 1993, she edited the first edition of Livestock Handling and Transport. Brandon wrote three chapters and included chapters from contributors from around the world. Subsequent editions of the book were published in 2000, 2007, and 2014. In her academic work as a professor at Colorado State University, her graduate student Bridget Boissonnette conducted one of the early studies that demonstrated that cattle who remained calm during handling had higher weight gains. In 1997, when the paper was published, this was a new concept. The paper is entitled "Feedlot Cattle with Calm Temperaments Have Higher Average Daily Gains Than Cattle with Excitable Temperaments."
I'm like, so do you even have to read the paper in order to know what it's about? Like, she wrote everything in the title.
I know, pretty much. It's just like, this is all I need to know. Keep your cows calm. They'll be fatter.
It's like one of those movie trailers where you see someone die and you're like, okay, well, like, should I even watch the movie?
Yeah, it gives everything away. Yeah. another important paper published by Grandin was Assessment of Stress During Handling and Transport in the Journal of Animal Science. This paper presented the science.
Sorry. I don't want to keep interrupting animal you, Alec. I'm sorry.
We're on one right now. Yeah. This paper presented the concept that an animal's previous experience with handling could have effect on how it will react to being handled in the future as a new concept in the animal handling industry, which I thought was kind of interesting. She'd mentioned in her TED talk how prevalent this concept is. I mean, which I've noticed in dogs mostly, like when you adopted a dog, like you don't know what their previous life was like. So you always have to be careful and, you know, mm-hmm. integrating them into your home, don't do certain things because of something that may have happened to them. And she mentions in her TED talk this horse that was abused by its previous owner, who would always wear a black cowboy hat. So whenever anybody in a black or dark cowboy hat would come around, this horse would freak out. So anybody handling the horse had to wear a light colored hat or not a hat at all, because it just like equated that. And that's what animals do. I mean, it's just like, which is kind of like how when people are just like, oh, my dogs don't like men and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Oh, my dog doesn't like blonde people. Just like they just breed the bad energy. I don't know.
I was like, what's my dog's problem then? He's afraid of everything. It's so annoying. I feel like it's gotten worse as he's gotten older. Like, I swear he did not used to be like this. And now he's literally like, he barks at everything. He's like afraid of literally everything. Like if I bring something out, he's like, what is that? I'm just like, oh my God, dude, stop. Like, you're annoying me right now.
A major piece of equipment that Grandin developed was a center track double rail conveyor restrainer system for holding cattle during stunning at large beef slaughtering plants. The first system was installed in the mid-1980s for calves, and a system for large beef cattle was developed in 1990. This equipment is now being used by many large meat companies, which I had, again, had zero concept on how any of that worked at a slaughtering house, but putting a cow on a conveyor belt seems like a very interesting concept. Like, even her drawings are just like, what, you're doing what with the cow now? And all those guys around
it's
the table,
dead, right? Like, oh my God. No, it's like to help, it's to help,
yeah, I think it's alive,
take them to, yeah,
yeah, and then they stun it and then it goes. Ooh. Yeah, but I guess they're chill when they're on this conveyor belt because of everything that Temple developed. I was like, what the heck. Sounds expensive. Grandin also developed an objective numerical scoring system for assessing animal welfare at slaughtering plants. The use of the scoring system resulted in significant improvements in animal stunning and handling during slaughter, which I thought was pretty cool. And again, makes me feel better about eating hamburgers. Because it's kind of like what she says in the movie. It's just kind of just like, well, you know, you can't stop the meat industry, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just kind of like, people are always going to eat meat, people are always going to eat beef, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But you might as well, if they're going to die, like, do it in a humane way, have them be comfortable. Yeah. Like, if they're going, no matter what, hopefully they're calm, hopefully they're at peace. And it's, that's just what, like, it makes you feel better.
Yeah, I read that in something else I was reading up on her. She was saying that she thinks, basically, like what you already said, like, she sees the importance or whatever of people eating meat, like, you know, that's going to be something that constantly happens. She's like, but we owe it to the animals to at least have them die. And like, if they're going to do this for us, be humane about it. Like, they deserve that respect, you know?
Yeah. In 2008, Grandin published Humane Livestock Handling with contributions by Mark Diesing, a longtime collaborator with her. The book contains a review of the main aspects of cattle behavior and provides a visual guide in the form of construction plans and diagrams for the implementation of Grandin's ideas relating to humane livestock handling. Grandin has lectured widely about her firsthand experiences of the anxiety of feeling threatened by everything in her surroundings and of being dismissed and feared, which motivates her work in humane livestock handling processes. She studied the behavior of cattle, how they react to ranchers, movements, objects, and light. Grandin then designed curved corrals she adapted with the intention of reducing stress, panic, and injury in animals being led to slaughter. This has proved to be a further point of criticism and controversy among animal activists who have questioned the congruence of a career built on animal slaughter alongside Grandin's claims of compassion and respect for animals. And it's just like we just said, it's just like, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. At least make it better for the animal.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't, like, freaking antagonize them on their way to freaking getting killed.
Yeah.
Like,
don't make it worse. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes me, but like, bothers me that animal activists are like, you know, questioning her career. It's like, actually what she's doing is a good thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like she very things. Much cares way more about these animals than how they had been treated for centuries. Like, while her designs are widely used throughout the slaughterhouse industry, her claim of compassion for the animals is that because of her autism, she can see the animals' reality from their viewpoint, that when she holds an animal's head in her hands as is being slaughtered, she feels a deep connection to them. Her business website promotes the improvement of standards for slaughterhouses and livestock farms. The squeeze machine, which I thought was interesting that they listed the prices if you can just like go buy one for yourself. The squeeze machine is sold at $4,525, which I don't actually think is that expensive compared to, you know, what it could be. Or, you know, you could build one yourself. In 2004, Grandin won a Proggy Award in the visionary category from People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. One of her notable essays about animal welfare is Animals Are Not Things, in which she proposes that technically animals are property in society, but the law ultimately gives them ethical protection or rights. She compares the properties and rights of owning cattle versus owning screwdrivers, detailing how both may be used to serve human purposes in many ways, but when it comes to inflicting pain, there is a vital distinction between such properties, because legally a person can smash or grind up a screwdriver, but cannot torture an animal. So
yeah.
Her insight into the minds of cattle has taught her to value the changes in details to which animals are particularly sensitive and to use her visualization skills to design thoughtful and humane animal handling equipment. She was named a fellow of the American Society of Agricultural and Biological Engineers in 2009. In 2012, when the American beef industry was struggling with public perception of its use and sale of pink slime, which I knew was a thing but didn't exactly know what it was. It's a meat byproduct used as a food additive to ground beef and beef-based processed meats as filler and to reduce the overall fat content of ground beef. yeah, it looks as it sounds like pink slime. Grandin spoke out in support of the food product. She said it should be on the market. It should be labeled. We should not be throwing away that much beef, which kind of she kind of says something similar when they put all of those intestines and such all over her car windshield, when she's like, I've eaten cow balls and this is a waste. I was like, oh my god. Grandin's work has attracted the attention of philosophers interested in the moral status of animals. One view found in the academic literature is that Grandin's method of slaughter is a significant positive development for animals, but her attempts to formulate a moral defense of meat eating have been less successful. So again,
I mean, it is like harder to convince somebody to eat something versus like to use a design. Yeah. But that really pissed me off in the movie where, you know, those ranch handlers messed with her design because they thought it was
wrong. I know, I was pissed. I was like,
me too.
And they freaking killed 3 cows in 2 seconds. This is like, really, is this working out for you the way that you're doing it, sir? I don't think so.
And then they try to blame her and she's like, I didn't put that there, you did.
Yeah, it's just it's just crazy to me because it's just like, boy, you can be let go and it would probably be cheaper for the farmer, you know, than you mm-hmm. killing all of these cows. It's like, doesn't do anybody any good.
Exactly. Well, and I was just thinking this, like, cause I feel like, you know, she is known for, you know, doing a lot for the slaughtering or whatever animal community or farming community. And, you know, autism community, but they don't really talk about, you know, like the, like for women, what she's done in like this type of field. Cause I feel like she did break a lot of barriers in that aspect too, because a lot of these men did, I feel like, go against her because of the fact that she was a woman in the field and she was like, you know, she had a lot of things stacked up against her, but she
persevered. Even they wouldn't even let her in because she was a woman.
Mm-hmm, exactly. But I thought it was cool that she stuck with it considering all the things, you know, she was up against really.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but it bothered me a little bit in the movie how they were in Arizona and like some people had a southern accent. I was like, I don't know if they have those accents in
Arizona. Maybe they imported them.
I know.
It like, made it seem way more country. I mean, not that I even know, but I don't think there is accents like that, at least.
I know. I mean that the where, you know, that like the cowboy look. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, maybe. I mean, if you're working out on like a cattle farm or whatever, maybe they do dress like that. But the accent.
Yeah. I mean, this was the 50s and 60s. And also Arizona isn't like the furthest from Texas and they have accents in Texas. So.
Oh, I always think of it as like it's right next to California.
Same. <Yeah. laughs> I'm like, shoot, my grandpa, his dad had a ranch and he dressed like a cowboy too. So, but he was also, I guess, originally from Oklahoma. So I don't know. Anyways. Okay. So next we're going to be learning about the work that she did that she continues to do within the autistic community, which we will get right into after this short ad break. Okay, welcome back. So now we're going to get into, you know, the work that she did for the autistic community. So yeah, so Temple was one of the first adults to disclose that she had autism. And she is well known for her work as a spokesperson for people with autism. I think this is kind of the main thing that she does. It seems like she, like we already talked about, she does a lot of speeches or talking events. And I think she just kind of gives like an inside perspective of what it's like to be a person with autism because, you know, people don't really understand because, you know, like I said, at that time, they didn't really know, especially like that scene in the movie where they were like, oh, how do you like get cured? And she's like, well, I'm not cured. And they're like, what? Like, you're still, you're doing all this stuff, whatever, and blah, blah, blah. Oliver Sacks, who I think he's another author. Cause I was like, who is this guy? Cause I like quoted him and I'm like, I don't know who he is. But anyways, Oliver Sacks wrote in the, oh yeah, he wrote a book. Oliver Sacks wrote in the foreword of Thinking in Pictures that her first book, Emergence, labeled autistic, was unprecedented because there had never been an inside narrative of autism. She basically gave people a better understanding of what autism is and is continuously helping people understand how people with autism think differently and may require different methods to learn. She encourages parents to cultivate their child's strengths and stretch them outside their comfort zones. And so, like you said, how she like has books where she kind of talks about like, you know, kind of giving tips, I guess you can say, to parents on how to, you know, help them. What is it? Not like, I don't know. I can't think of a right word, but basically just how to kind of like get them to like be more than, you know, what society or like their doctors are kind of like telling them that they can do. So she even said things like, she encourages us a lot because that's kind of what helped her get where she's at. And, you know, her mom never really gave up on her. She kind of like made her do things that she wasn't comfortable with. Cause she was saying that, like, you know, if you keep your kid in their comfort zone, they're never going to like be able, they are going to be stuck basically in what they're at, at the level that they're at. They're not going to ever be able to order at a restaurant or whatever. So she's saying like, if you do things like that, where you go to a restaurant, make them order, if that's outside their comfort zone, that's going to eventually help them. Because she said that she saw a lot of people who, you know, can't live on their own or, you know, can't hold a job. And it's because of the parents not making them do these things when they were, you know, a young child or whatever. Temple me. Talks at you,
me,
dude, I used to hate that shit when I was a kid, when my mom would make me order shit. I'm like, do not make me do this.
Dude, me too. My dad made me do that one time at McDonald's and I was like freaking out the whole time. And he's like, okay, stop. Halfway through, he's like, you could stop now.
You're embarrassing me.
But I mean, I think that's just like a good true thing just for like we said, like any kid in general, they need to be kind of pushed outside their comfort zone to kind of see what they are capable of doing. You know, they might not think they're capable of doing it, but once they do it, they see that they are indeed able to do it and can do it on their own, possibly in the future.
I don't think it's just like autistic kids or even kids in general. I think that it's just everything, like even us as adults, like we get into our own comfort zone as well. And sometimes we also have to look at ourselves like, hey, I've never tried this. I should actually try it. Like I'm interested. I should actually try it. Yeah.
And I think that's what she also talks about. It's just like, yeah, like, you know, obviously these are all things that everyone faces. It's just that people with autism might have to go about it in a different way. Like she said that they, like, you know, all people learn differently, but people with autism have like an extra degree, I guess, of different in which that they have to kind of go about things. And so, yeah, she just, and I'm going to get into like the three different types of things that she says people learn, in a little bit. So yeah, Temple talks at many events and has written books about her experience with autism and her observations about it. She has played a big role in shifting the way people view those with autism. I think some of the things that are interesting to me about when I was reading about her was that her kind of like her ability to recognize that some of her assessments, how she used to think about people with autism, could like how she thought her previous assessments might be wrong. I guess I'm trying to like get that sense out. So she used to characterize herself as a recovered autistic person, but in her later writings, she stopped using this characterization, and she realized that she didn't recover from anything, but she learned to adapt the social norms that surrounded her. So when her book Thinking in Pictures was written in 1995, Grandin thought that all individuals with autism thought in photographic specific images the way she did. By the time the expanded edition was published in 2006, she had realized that it had been wrong to presume that every person with autism processed information in the same way she did. In the 2006 edition, she wrote that there were three types of specialized thinking. They were: one, visual thinkers like she is, who think in photographically specific images; two, music and math thinkers, who think in patterns and may be good at mathematics, chess, and programming computers; and three, verbal logic thinkers, people who think in word details. And she noted that their favorite subject might be history. And then these concepts were again further expanded in her book, The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. So I'm not entirely sure if there are, because obviously this is just her idea of what the different ways people with autism might learn or whatever, or think. So I don't know what the other people have different interpretations of this. I'm sure there are different ones. But I think that's cool that she kind of is able to recognize that, you know, like she said, not everyone's like her. There are people that, again, think differently, and not one person is the same, people with autism. And yeah, so that's pretty much all her work. I know she's written way more books than even the ones that I've mentioned. As I said too before, she has done some children's books as well. And yeah, she's just all over the place with her little TED Talks and speeches and whatnot. I did see that she did have that TED Talk, but I was like, maybe later I'll watch that, and I just never did. But yeah, that's our girl Temple Grandin.
Good old Temple.
Yeah. I just think, yeah, she's a cool chick. I just feel like her field that she studied is kind of just can't hold my interest though. Like, I'm like, okay.
I mean, the only thing I can real like have any interest in is how she wants to do like humane slaughter. Yeah. You know, that's pretty, because I definitely think that too. It's with when I eat meat, like I want to make sure it's the best like way.
The best meat totally. I can eat.
No, it's just, yeah, but I sometimes have problems because like if somebody's like, oh, it grosses me out, like some, and I'm just like, but how do you think it gets to your plate? Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't think about the slaughter, you have to. So anyways, I don't know if we want to tell, like, put this story in there. I guess I'll decide when I'm editing. But when I was in fourth grade, they introduced an autistic girl into our class. And I remember before they introduced her to our class, like they had this, like the teacher gave this huge speech with, I think like a principal, I don't remember who, but anyways, they were like, oh, she's super smart. You know, she like reads sixth grade level, you know, obviously you're in fourth grade, you're like, whoa. She could do math really well. It's just, they just wanted to give us the heads up that she just was like socially just different, and that technically she's diagnosed as autistic. And anyways, like I felt so bad because I don't know why. Oh, I'm trying to think, like, why did they choose my class? I think because there was another girl in that class that, like, they went to church together, so they already knew each other. Mm-hmm. And that girl was also like, she's so nice. Like, she was also saying like great things about her. Anyways, when she got introduced to our class, it didn't go well. And I know, I remember just like not understanding why the other kids in my class didn't like her. I mean, mm-hmm. to this day, I don't understand, and I'm never going to go and ask them, but she talked like Temple, right? Like just kind of loud and blunt, I guess, mm-hmm. and didn't have like the inflections to kind of help with the emotion mm-hmm. side. So that was like the only part that kind of was jarring to me. But other than that, like, I thought she was super nice. I mean, it was easy to talk to her other than that. And anyways, yeah, she kind of got mistreated.
Yeah.
And they took her out. I think
it probably just has to do with the fact that, like, even Temple has it, like, people don't really know, they can't put themselves, like, they can't understand why, like you said, like, why the person's like that. So because they can't understand it, they just like kind of reject it in some sense. Because have you guys watched that one show, Love on the Spectrum?
No, that's on Netflix or yeah, it's on Amazon. Netflix. Okay.
Yeah. I watched the first season. I like the first season a lot, but it's like, true. Like, it's kind of like these people, they all have autism, but like, there's something unique about each of one of them. Like, you know, they learn, like, they are, some of them are like really into like a specific hobby, or like one guy, he's like really into dinosaurs, so he knows like a shit ton of facts about the dinosaurs and stuff like that, like all these facts. And it's just like them trying to like date and like getting outside of their comfort zones, and like, and a lot of them are on different like levels, I guess, of the, you know, like, you know, of the spectrum. Some are more independent than others, and it's just really interesting because it gives you like an inside perspective of how these people, like, you know, view the world and how they interact with people, and kind of like their thoughts on how people treat them and how, you know, how they kind of see the world. So it's really interesting. And I think that's just kind of what it is. Like, people don't know, or like they can't, you know, relate to it in any way. So they just don't know, like, they just don't understand it. So they kind of just like keep it at a distance from them.
Yeah. I think because we were kids, what, like we were like 9, 10 years old.
Super young.
Mm-hmm. Just some of the kids just couldn't understand why. Like, it's like you were told why she's different. I don't, mm-hmm. I guess for me when I was, yeah. And then the other thing about that, I mean, like, I experienced this, and like the other girl who knew her beforehand, I think we also kind of felt awkward hanging out with her or even talking to her, because the other kids, like, you know, it was just us two versus like the other 28 kids in class, and the other 28 kids are like not accepting her. And so us two are kind of like, we don't mind you, but like, I also don't want to get too close because I don't want to also get bullied by the other kids, you know? And so, yeah, I guess like in hindsight, they just couldn't wrap their heads around what was going on in her mind.
I think one thing too, Temple was saying in, I don't know, some interview article, was that she kind of feels, I think to some degree, that a lot of, you know, smart people or just people in general are all kind of like on the spectrum, or all have some kind of form of autism. Because she was insane. She's like, yeah, Steve Jobs. Like, she was talking about Steve Jobs and how she thinks that he probably was on the spectrum or whatever. And I forget why exactly she was saying, but she was like saying these things about it. And like, just, she's like, yeah, I think every person that's like really, really like crazy smart has like some degree of it, or even if it's like a small, you know, part. But she was saying that she basically thinks everyone has some aspect of it in them. But
yeah, she talked about that in her TED talk too. It's just like kind of like how you shouldn't shun, you know, kids or other people for these abilities when, like, realistically we need people that are that smart. And like, specifically because, I mean, she was talking about like Silicon Valley and stuff like that. And, and she was talking a lot about autism versus Asperger's and stuff like that. And, you know, there are some people that has Mark Zuckerberg ever come out to say that he has Asperger's?
Really? I don't know.
No, I feel like that's what people always say.
Oh, really?
It's like, well, clearly, yeah, it's just like clearly, but it's just like, and it's not, but clearly it's like, it's not anything to be ashamed of. It's just like you just it's have just abilities different. That other people don't. And it's just like, that's awesome.
Yeah. I would say, I think they're just able, I mean, at least for the people we're talking about, they're just able to see, because they can see the world differently, they're able to solve problems that we don't even like think about, or like think that we need have a solution for. And I think that's
cool. Yeah. Cause ultimately I guess the thing that's missing is like the way they socialize. And it's like, oh, really? We're going to reject somebody because they can't socialize like us. Like, you know, even the way people socialize in different countries is different. It's like, you know, sometimes we just need to take our nose down a little bit, but
anything else, y'all?
No.
Okay.
Be good.
Thanks for joining us this week on The Internet Historians. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and give us a rating. We would also love to connect with you. So give us a follow on Instagram and subscribe to us on YouTube. Next week, we'll be discussing Katharine Graham from the movie The Post. So don't forget to tune in. Thanks again, and we will see you next week. Bye.